need to go. Okay, perfect. And we will also do a recording here. Okay, great. Okay, so hello, buddy. Welcome to the Addiction 911 show. I'm so happy that you're here today. We have two panelists with us, the Rabbi Mark Rottenberg of Recovery Bootcamp. And we have also Harold Jonas of Sober Network. And we're very excited to have both these addiction specialists and experts here today. And I want to have them each introduce themselves in a little more detail. So we'll start with you. Now, can I refer you both to Harold and Mark, or would you like me to say Dr. Harold and Rabbi? Okay. Okay, I think it's easier. Okay. Harold, tell us all about you and what exactly you do with Sober, with the Sober Network.
Thank you, Christina, for the invitation to participate. My name is Dr. Harold Jonas, and I am located in Delray Beach, actually a neighbor of the Recovery Bootcamp, right on the other side of Atlantic Avenue. I have been in town now since 1987, active in the transformation of the recovery kind of community here in Delray, as well as South Florida and nationwide. Started with housing in 95 here in town. Grew it into a website called sober.com and have now morphed it into now a broader based kind of intervention called Sober Network. And what we're currently launching here in the next few weeks is the latest is an incentivized program called SoberCoin to help people really reach their treatment goals through a cryptocurrency that I've created in the Ethereum network. So that's the next plan and morphing into what we're growing to. We've watched a lot of people here in town as well as across nationwide, of course, become, I dare say the word victims of, but certainly fallen to the disease of addiction and to the opiate epidemic that's invaded us and is upon us. And certainly want to contribute in a larger scale. I'm a licensed therapist and have seen a lot of things up close and personal, both professionally and in my family. So that's it in a nutshell and what we're looking at trying to contribute.
Great. Thank you so much, Harold. And Mark, tell us about you and the Recovery Bootcamp.
Well, I am presently at Recovery Bootcamp. I've been in the field for about 17 years. I've always been a clinician. I started off in California as a certified drug and alcohol counselor, then became a therapist, then became a clergyman, and have combined, in essence, into a sort of interesting sort of mishmash of therapeutic approach, specifically a psycho-spiritual therapeutic approach. Blending, you know, I guess Carl Jung called it moral psychology. Now we bring it into the psycho-spiritual realm. And I am here as the minister to community, as well as the case manager at Recovery Bootcamp. I've been here for almost 3 years. It's a 12-step immersion, heavy cycling, very strong alumni pro-based program. And I operate as the minister to the community, the case manager, as well as group facilitators. I do both the PHP and the IOP groups here. We try to bring a deeper understanding on a spiritual level of the standalone cognitive process that are the steps to the people that are here. So they have a background when they transition out, something a little bit deeper than just a quick run through.
Great. Wonderful. Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you both for your introductions. And so how the show's going to work is we're going to go over some of the breaking news that's happening right now, you know, in the last couple of days, because so many things change and there's so much information that the viewers out there really need to know, whether you're dealing with addiction yourself or of a loved one. And something that I just saw, maybe it was about a week ago, authorities seized 118 pounds of fentanyl, enough to kill millions, that's millions of people in a Nebraska bust. And from what I understand, there is a ring in China that this is coming from. There was a businessman, I think, I don't know if he's arrested or he's under investigation. They're actually putting this fentanyl. So for people who don't understand, I'll ask you, Harold, first. Tell us what fentanyl is and what the problem is and how it's killing so many people.
Thank you. Fentanyl is a derivative, obviously, of an analgesic, and it's significantly more powerful than what's on the street. Back in the day, a 4-milligram Dilaudid was what the most powerful drug was available, and then they invented fentanyl for really severe people suffering from pain, chronic pain, in the sense that they were bone marrow cancer victims. That's who got fentanyl back in the 80s. And then it's morphed into something to become way more attractive because it's a very long-acting chemical that unfortunately is incredibly devastating on your central nervous system, shuts it down immediately. We're seeing people not even get basically the methodology being injection, which is preferred, out of their arm before they're dead. People are requiring multiple higher doses of Narcan in order to be revived. And this particular interdiction, which is significant, obviously, where quite a few people would be subject to possibly dying as a result of using the fentanyl, if they use it in the purest form, would be devastating. What's happening in the culture of the drug dealer, so to speak, is they're cutting other street drugs, if you would, not just heroin or cocaine, but I'm reading about marijuana being laced with fentanyl. The MDMA is being laced with fentanyl, and everything is really centering around this long-acting analgesic that gives you a euphoric feeling and then obviously a long-acting pain relief, both psychically and physically.
This is really scary, especially what you're saying about it being brought into other drugs like marijuana, so people having no idea. And Mark, so are you seeing this happen? I mean, I've heard stories of people who, you know, they think they're taking a Xanax or smoking a joint, and then they're actually dying, having no idea that this fentanyl is in there. And to think that there's this one, you know, they seized pounds of this, 118 pounds, enough to kill millions of people. This is scary stuff. So what has been your experience with this, Mark?
Well, we see it being problematic with a number of accidental overdose deaths, because what occurs is, as the doctor so aptly put it, is that we have this very, very potent drug that is easily manufactured. It's a complete synthetic. And so it's, you know, in terms of business, it's a smart model for the drug dealer, but it's horrible for the recipients. And because it is so, microdoses themselves are so deadly and so toxic that really these dealers are not investing the time with the proper, they don't have the stuff to mix it correctly. So any batch of any drug that they're altering with the fentanyl is going to have a guaranteed what we call hot shot, right? So there's going to be a certain section where people are inevitably going to die. The distortion of the addict in the moment is that when they hear about someone dying, that's the drug they want to try. You know, it's that twisted kind of sense of reality that we twist our minds into, as the doctor said. Over time, we affect ourselves in this kind of like hyper-spiritual convoluted manner where we want, I heard my buddy overdosed and that's dope I want to get.
Really?
You know, and it's really kind of disturbing. Not only that, but you have people that are cycling through, that are getting a little bit of abstinence, getting some clean time, and they're going out. And even in their brain, they're being conscientious. They're saying, okay, well, I was used to doing this dose for my wake up, I'm going to drop it down. But because of the unknown factor of fentanyl being involved in those drugs, a lot of times they fall out their first, second, or third shot immediately after a small amount of abstinence. And it's tragic, very tragic. And it's hard, like the doctor said, multiple Narcans.
Right.
This
really
is brutal. Very scary. I mean, when you think about the young kids, you know, maybe 14, 15 years old who aren't, let's say they're not addicts, but they're at a party experimenting like most teenagers do. It's not like it was. I mean, now your parents have to worry that your child can accidentally die because whatever they took was laced. What would you say? I'll start with Harold. What would you say to parents right now, you know, who have teenagers or have young, you know, 20-year-olds? And what advice? I mean, because kids don't want to listen. You know, you say don't do the drugs, obviously. But, you know, they're going to be in these situations. I'm not talking about people who are actually addicted yet, but that are experimenting like many college kids do and high school kids. How does a parent warn them that this, you know, this is not, you could die from doing this? What is the best way to approach that?
Well, unfortunately, education is not the solution for a teenager. My experience with the adolescent population is that kids listen to kids. They don't listen to adults. So I mean, I think we all know that, those of us who are parents. I've raised four and had similar experiences with all of them growing and maturing through their experimentation phase. Although I did lose one recently,
I'm so sorry.
Which was incredibly challenging and still is to talk about, especially here on camera. Who moved in a direction of continued addiction despite any number of variables, being that both of his parents are active in recovery, he's never been exposed to drug use, blah, blah, blah. And that's not really wasn't enough of a deterrent in his world. What happens to people when they start to use at such a young age is their brain formulates around that reward system, and he continues to seek that reward being pleasure and that saturation. Nothing seems to really, really ever take its place. So as they move through tolerance with opiates, whether it's pot as an entry drug or alcohol as an entry drug, and they move into that tolerance factor and more curiosity, like the rabbi said, you know, they're going to go to where the most powerful thing is, because they're, again, adolescents are very, very disenfranchised. If you look at today's world and social media, there's so many different things that are same but different. For us growing up, we're all maybe peers in a lot of ways of what we were exposed to. Same thing through normal adolescent development and experimentation, and then catching them before they go two or three standard deviations out from the norm. Parents have to pay attention to who their kids are interacting with. That's the most critical thing that I share with all parents I work with, is if you don't pay attention to who they're interacting with and try to steer them in a direction of connectivity, whether it's through religion, sports, after-school activities, something of that nature, you're going to lose them. You're going to lose them to a peer group that's, like, devastating. And then this whole, you know, languaging about an accidental overdose. Anybody that uses drugs anymore, they're doing it by choice, as we all know, and that's the whole idea, is to restore choice to them through a treatment model, and that's a whole nother conversation, how that treatment model is most effective, but the restoration of choice, and then once they pick up again because the receptors are clean, whether it's through an abstinence-based thing, is that then they're saturated and dead. I mean, it's like that quick. And wow. And we know that from experience. They read about it. They hear about it. They go to funerals of their friends. And again, that invincibility of adolescence is it'll never happen to me.
And that's the problem. And Mark, you'd agree with that, right? It's just that they think they're invincible, especially teenagers, and they just don't understand. And many, not only teenagers, 20 or 30-year-olds or older, they don't think that it's going to happen to them. And then, unfortunately, the odds are now much greater with this fentanyl on the streets, that you can seriously die from taking one illegal pill or a couple hits off a joint.
I agree. And the doctor mentioned this kind of peer education type of dynamic, which is hugely important for people at that age. But what's also sometimes and quite often equally as important is education for the parents themselves. And what we have to understand is the systems dynamics being what they are, family dynamics being what they are, there's transference and countertransference and projections without even anybody's knowledge. And there's a lot of like projected guilt and ideas about what I did. I wasn't a good parent. I didn't do this right. I didn't do that right. And for instance, we run here at RBC, we run a webinar every Thursday night for families. It's an 18-week course. And we talk all about the disease, modeling, the entire process, and focus heavily on boundaries, how we write boundaries, how we prevent enabling, how we do these things. And if you look just at the NIH and the numbers across the board, the chances for an adolescent, an early adult to attain long-term recovery is increased exponentially when the family themselves get education and treatment for their own mental problems that they really just get by osmosis, just by proximity to the identified patient, causes the family to get corrupted and sick as well. And a lot of the education, you know, the doctor said that the parents have to be aware of who they're hanging out with and what they're doing. And that's really based in the education and then developing solid boundaries. Solid boundaries are not going to control the adolescent's behavior, but they're going to protect them and their mental health so that they can be in a stable position if crisis does occur for that child. Very, very important.
Yeah, I think
if I might add, Christina, real quickly, the parents' anxiety about their kids is so significant and playing into that same theme there with Mark was saying. But the most important thing with families is that both parents have to agree on the parenting style. of how that's going to occur, because kids are just great at being able to split parents. And if there's any weakness in the system, they're going to find it, because that's basically what their job is to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And that's part of, you know, a recurrence of a developmental process and so forth. So their whole disenfranchisement, their apathy, their depression of adolescence compared to other kids, blah, 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 all these things that, you know, they go through. Look, I have a whole bunch of biases around this, so I have to be very, very careful so I get invited back. I'll save that for another conversation. Uh-huh. But why these things occur across our country, and they're not limited to South Florida or to metropolitan areas, but they're going on right now in the middle of Illinois with a different drug. They're using methamphetamine, or they're making, you know, something else to take them out of their psychic pain of finding their way at this time between 14 and 18. You're like, what do I do? What do I want to be when I grow up? And you know, they look at the world and are like, maybe not. You know, let me delay that decision. So that's part of what's happening, where adolescence, you know, for me, at my age, adolescence, you were done at 18. You know, that's it. And then it went to 21, and now it's up to 26, and now it's even extended to 30. Because you're now can stay on mom and dad's insurance until you're 30, with exceptions. So, like, what they're like, what's the rush? What's the rush? What's the hurry? And then they look at their parents who, you know, are struggling, and you know, then it's not so attractive to them, you know, because you have all the one percenters and then the rest of us, and that's what the world is.
It is really scary times. I mean, I have four children as well. I have my two sons are now 24 and 25, and they really, as teenagers, boy, did they give me a run for my money. But now, thankfully, they're in a good place. But what is really scary, and we live in South Florida, is we moved to New Jersey. It started, they lost so many friends, died. I mean, I was shocked how many friends died up in New Jersey first. And then it's mm-hmm. right down here. Just a couple weeks ago, another one of their friends from school died. Again, yeah. Suddenly 24 years old, you know, suspecting it was the drugs. It's like an epidemic. I've never seen anything like this growing up. I never lost. I grew up in the 80s, you know, there was cocaine. I never, ever saw heroin. There was marijuana. There was alcohol. That was basically all you saw. And I never.
We were pretty hedonistic. Back in the 80s, it was pretty hedonistic, and we're talking about Studio 54 and the beginning of Plato's Retreat and the whole decadence world back then. I'm from Philadelphia. I'm familiar with the Northeast Corridor. But again, we're not limited to this, you know, metropolitan urban area of New York suburbs, you know, all the way down to D.C. to Boston. This is going across the country, you know, and there's this whole thing. And this epidemic. So I read this article, and I read this article last week. And it was a post from a gentleman, and this is, you know, where I'm coming from, is that, you know, this epidemic creates like I'm a victim of a disease thing. You know, I'm a victim of an epidemic, when in fact that's not accurate at all, because there's a whole population that's been struggling with opiate addiction since 1960, since the Vietnam War, you know, when it started to infiltrate back then. And they were never victims. They were always just drug addicts. And I'm talking about the African-American community, the Hispanic community, lower class white, who have been exposed and been using opiates for a long time, and they've never been classified as victims, so to speak. They've always been drug addicts and criminals. So there's a big divide that's still now existing, and even more so, even in the recovery, so to speak, community, that, you know, people in the suburbs are victims of a disease, when in fact there is no such thing except a willing participant.
Well, you know, that's true. And I think, you know, before we move on to the next topic here, I just want to say, any parents who are watching this, or if you have dealing with, you know, young teenagers or children in their 20s, exactly what both Mark and Harold said today is, you know, is the friends. That's crucial. You know, really pay attention to who your kids are hanging out with, and, you know, and definitely discuss this with them, you know, and just because unfortunately, this is, like you said, going back to the original subject, you know, 118 pounds of fentanyl. I mean, that's millions of people, but we've got a serious problem in our country here. So just moving on to our next topic, and I'll start with Mark. Recently in the news, forced rehab has been questioned in the addiction battle. We have about 35 states currently have provisions that allow the families or medical professionals to petition a judge who can order an individual into treatment if they deem that person's a threat to themselves or others. Here it's called, I believe, the Marchman Act in Florida. But there has been, lately in the news, has been resistance to this. And there's some states questioning whether they should continue with this. Mark, what is your opinion on, like in Florida, we call it the Marchman Act, but this whole forced into treatment, does it work? And do you think it should continue?
Well, I absolutely believe it should continue. Forced interventions may not work in the moment, but in my experience, there's no such thing as a failed intervention in the long run. I started my career in California, and they were doing Title 24 and sentencing to treatment. And what the numbers across the board over long-term tracking show is that when you add secondary and tertiary restrictions, additive, things that are punitive in nature, it actually increases the probability of long-term recovery from the client themselves. I mean, you also have to understand that someone who wants to go to treatment, who wants to get sober, is in essence making a Hobson's choice. They don't want sobriety because it's foreign to them. What they want is a cessation of the trauma and misery that they are participating in at the moment, which is fine, right? That's the initial impetus that allows somebody to get where they need to go. But having a secondary overhanging punitive reality or a tertiary, a third or fourth or even fifth stage possibility that reinforces the necessity for them to stay abstinent for at least the amount of time to get past post-acute withdrawal, to let them get neurologically and physiologically reconstituted into some homeostasis, do some work, therapeutic, cognitive, all of these things, it increases the probability of their chances to stay sober. Also, even if they do have relapses or tend to go out or they minimize their disease, the information is not lost. It still exists. It's still in their head, and they're still aware of it. And so it may take multiple incarnations, but the truth is there is no such thing as a failed intervention. And the numbers specifically show that long-term treatment works long-term, and when it is mandated and there's secondary and tertiary things hanging over their head, the numbers get increased, 15 to 20% higher success rate across the board. In mandatory.
That's good to know. And Harold, what is your opinion on forced rehab?
Force is a pretty strong word. I know the languaging in some of these articles is
right. I'm just pulling it right from the headlines.
In the intervention world, which I've been part of for very many years until it became somewhat driven by things other than the person. The actual word we would use is coerced, and it's coerced. And when we do interventions, which I still do, we're looking at really accessing what little bit of health is left in that individual when we do a structured intervention. Of course, all this got somewhat corrupted and unfortunately, Hollywood angle presented with the TV show, and that's not really the way we do it professionally. I've had a lot of success as far as having people go with coercion and sticking in this treatment center and having that magic happen of, yeah, this isn't so bad. External control is what I think Mark was referring to in terms of increasing the likelihood of long-term abstinence. Abstinence is not equal recovery, and it's a whole new definition of what recovery really constitutes now. But most importantly, from my perspective, is that we want to help people make better decisions for themselves, which is contributing to the community, their family, and to their own well-being, however that's accomplished. We know that criminal justice has not been a very effective intervention. People don't learn anything really rehabilitative in a setting like that, and they can't build enough jails and institutions like that fast enough and staff them fast enough anyway. So we're really in a quandary in terms of how we're going to respond to the crisis that keeps getting, a lot of PR and TV time, this crisis that has actually been in existence as long as I've been around. My whole life has either been watching people use drugs, using drugs myself, or helping other people get off of drugs. So it's, a good 60-year run, and it's been around way before I was born. So we're not talking about anything new. We're just talking about a lot more people because there's a lot more people, and there's a lot more ways to connect with those people. And my methodologies of how that happens is going to be through their cell phone.
And so if somebody is watching, and I'll ask you, Mark, or this, a loved one of somebody, and they're debating whether or not they should, you know, get that person marchment active here in Florida or use any of the other ways to get that person into where I think you're both saying it does help increase the chances of them getting better, and it's better than them dying. It's probably definitely worth a shot if you feel they are harming themselves. So, Mark, right. Would you say, you know, go ahead, do it. Don't let feel guilty. Just this is something for the person.
Yeah, absolutely do it. And, you know, enlist the help of professionals that have a long-term experience in recovery. And the doctor's right, abstinence and recovery are different things, but attaining a modicum of abstinence in a controlled environment where the locus of control is focused on the professionals allows them to get to the point where maybe recovery becomes an amenable kind of idea for them, where it becomes attractive. And bringing in professionals is always a good idea. And education in the families, I mean, what we have to understand is there's a societal problem as well. Even though since the early 40s, the NIH and AMA has considered alcoholism and drug addiction a disease in the mesolimbic system, we now know, it's still stigmatized, you know, and we don't want to cast that shame. We don't want to keep people in the dark. The shadow is what keeps people sick. And the truth is yes, we are all willing participants in using, but so are so many people who never become addicts because it's a perfect storm, right? It's almost this kind of conspiracy, genetic predisposition, environmental, all of these things combined to make us, it's not our fault we're addicts, but it is our obligation to get sober, to get clean, to have recovery. And society still looks at it through the lens of stigma, that it's a drug addict, they're weak-willed. You know, the doctor mentioned it when you're talking about minority populations, the distortion of view. He's absolutely correct, and it still exists that way. So anything that you can do vis-a-vis education, eliciting the help of professionals, bringing an intervention through that coercive treatment is huge because it's tough love. Boundaries, tough love, no enabling. Enabling is doing for them something they can and must do for themselves. You have to do for yourself. You have to bring them to the table. They have to make the choice. Anything you can do to bring someone to the table is a hugely proactive thing. I would much rather have someone hate me than then be dead, you know? And as a family member, that's the option you have to take, the mindset. I would much rather have them be vehemently angry at me than to see them dead on my couch in the morning. Not going to happen. Tough love is what it is.
Well, yeah, that's easier said than done, as we talked about, you know, parental anxiety. And most importantly, before we get too far along, every one of these states and their legislative bodies that created these instruments, having filed multiple Marchman Acts with people on behalf of people, you know, let's not put a lot of stock in that only because of my experience with the length of time it takes. And now with the potency of the drugs that people are using, this would not be the forum to educate, but you can go to the internet, download a Marchman Act and look at the statutes here in Florida on how it works. So you have some understanding before you call a professional, before you decide to pick up the phone and say, I want an intervention. You know, when people call me, I work for the family. I don't work for the addict because the addict's always going to do what the addict does, regardless of what we do. We want to get the family into a healing process and stop the splitting in that system. As Mark has said over and over again, it's most important that the family gets educated on how they're going to respond, because what they've been doing to this point is continuing to allow this and permit it in their life. And the addict, again, the active drug user, which we might also add here if it may be apropos, is really the minority. A lot of people use alcohol and they're not alcoholics. A lot of people use marijuana and they're not addicted. A lot of people use Xanax every day and they're not addicted. So we still haven't figured out scientifically why some people cross that line. And that may be, you know, the magic pill everybody's continuing to look for in terms of brain chemistry and neurology and et cetera. Whether we'll see it in our lifetime remains to be seen. But most importantly is that we have to deal with our own internal anxieties and our own empowerment as people and make more clearly informed decisions about how we're going to conduct our lives and how it's going to affect people we love and people that love us.
I agree with the doctor. I just frame it in terms of spirituality. Everything that he says, I approach it from the spiritual end of the spectrum. But it's identical. It's identical. Okay. You know, personal empowerment is what it's about. You know, it's just to look at the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. People talk about, I'm powerless, I'm powerless, I'm powerless, I'm powerless. The word powerless appears one time in the body of the text, in past tense. The entire book is predicated on the idea of receiving power, becoming empowered, utilizing it to make informed decisions and free will, and making your life better, making your life different. Quality of life is what it's all about. I agree 100%.
Absolutely. And depending on the legislature and the police and the pickup orders and the incarceration that the people are threatened right. with, and you know, it can sometimes be an exercise in futility, but throughout, the family is communicating and communicating with one another. That in itself can be very, very helpful and soothing.
Yeah,
and unlike the kitchen, where too many cooks spoil the broth, in this field, the more information, the more people active, the more people on the same team, unable to be triangulated, unable to be
right.
unified front, that is the strongest way to have efficacy in treating your identified patient, 100%.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think you could really do the best that you can do, because I know there are people who are probably watching this who maybe, unfortunately, did everything they could in their power and still lost someone to addiction. And, you know, some people will live with that guilt. Maybe I didn't do enough. I did too much enabling. But ultimately, Robin Mark, what you just said was about, you know, free will. You know, it's obvious it's a disease and there's not, but it's going to come down to the path of that person. I mean, you can't control another human being, of course. You can do everything in your power and try to help that person, but ultimately you're not responsible, you know, at the end, if God forbid, you know, a tough love, you know, they say hit rock bottom. Sometimes the bottom is death, unfortunately, you know, and we're seeing this. And I think a lot of parents and loved ones struggle with that, you know, after the fact, if God forbid a tragedy occurs, that they, you know, they're devastated thinking they could have done more. So I'll just, Harold, what would you say to that somebody, a parent who's now, you know, lost somebody and thinking, God, I could have done more? You know, what would your advice be to them if they're watching?
I'm listening and processing simultaneously, and the reason being, as I mentioned earlier, we just lost our 27-year-old.
I didn't know that. My gosh.
And he struggled, and we struggled as a family through his active use and then abstinence and active use. And this is the irony, is that as a parent, I was blessed with a phone call because there was a traffic fatality as opposed to an overdose. Now, that's how crazy and upside down and convoluted life has become, where a family like ours, who has an active addict in their life, is happy we didn't get that call, we found your son from an overdose, but there was a traffic occurrence. We got a chance as his parents to let him go, you know, in the trauma unit. Just 5 weeks ago.
Oh my gosh, I am so sorry.
And it was, it's really, you know, raw. And I'm sitting here and my parenting style was different than his mom's. And unfortunately, those are some of the outcomes of what occurred in our family. And it's a devastating blow and something to really kind of crazy to be talking about here live on camera. But in fact, I'm one of those grieving parents as we speak, and also a professional, that it was only his father and not his therapist, of course, and only her husband and not her therapist. And yet we as a family are going through this situation of having lost somebody, not directly to drug use, but indirectly, because that's the way it occurs very, very frequently. As we all know, the obituaries often say what they say. But they allude to things, but they don't directly say this person had cirrhosis of the liver because they drank too much. They say they died of medical complications. You know, they kind of, and this is part of that stigma that Mark had mentioned earlier. If we tell the truth, people can then make better decisions and join together to support one another with what's happening. And that is that we're losing our youth, you know, at a rapid pace. You know, which is very, very frightening and but not fixable. Everything's fixable if we stay focused and really straight ahead on our course of well-being.
Wow, I am so sorry, and thank you so much, Doctor, for, you know, being so brave to come here and share today with us to help others and share your expertise, you know, despite what you've been going through in your family. because there's people I know who, you know, parents out there all in the same boat right now, you know, worried or dealing with this addiction with their loved one. And it's just, it's a horrible place to be in. So.
And that is the word that we used over and over again was it's horrible, it's horrible, it's horrible. And it is, and it's incredibly painful. They can't get intellectualized away. But I'm, you know, I'm not guilty of doing anything but loving my kid. That's what
exactly.
We do. And we all love our children the way we were modeled how to love, or we overcompensate because we didn't get loved. I'm a product of the World War II generation parents. I'm a baby boomer. That parenting style that was, you know, we saw in Mad Men and that whole period piece, you know, it's a whole different thing socioculturally. So now we have a new generation of parents who are embracing their children and loving their children and building self-esteem and still to have the same outcomes, despite, because it always is going to come down to that critical time and their peer group selection. And even though we steered and guided and steered and intervened and steered and guided and intervened, free will runs wild.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And we don't stop loving, right? We don't stop loving because that's what parents do. We love unconditionally.
Absolutely. And Rabbi, what, you have any thoughts on that?
I just defer to the doctor, and you have my deepest condolences for your loss. And I know, and the only thing I can say is that as a clergyman who's been in this field for 17 years, my biggest dilemma is that I do far more funerals than I do weddings, truthfully, all the time. And that's just the bottom line. And I can't tell you the last time I did a funeral for somebody over 35. I can't remember it.
Oh, see, that's absolutely frightening, you know, and I think that we have to, like, as a society, you know, I think we don't want to deal with this, yet it's happening in front of us, and we keep our, you know, we have our heads in the sand, most of us, you know, just dealing, we hear about the news, but it's not something we want to deal with until it hits home, until you know somebody, until you have a family member who's suffering with it. I'm going to switch gears a little bit to something else that's been lately in the news, and this is the question of, could cannabis be the answer to treating opiate addiction? Now, CNN's Sanjay Gupta, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, just wrote a piece on how marijuana can break opiate addiction. He used to be against this, and now he's believing in the science that it can help. So it's, you know, what are your feelings on this? We can start, Mark, we'll start with you, and then we'll go over to Dr. Harrell. What is your feelings on treating with cannabis the opiate addiction?
Well, the problem with cannabis is because of dysregulation, there's no actually quality assurance. And we're talking about two specific psychotropic chemicals. The first psychotropic hallucinogen is delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, which is probably the single most potent naturally occurring psychotropic hallucinogen that grows. The second one is CBD, which we find, now we're talking about like a pretty substantial amount of anecdotal evidence talking about its ability to stem meiotic division of cancer cells, to allow as an analgesic, to work as a as an anti-inflammatory, to actually affect the neuroreceptor of opioids in a positive manner. And the Israelis are really at the cutting edge of this in terms of being sanctioned by the government to actually do these type of things. And all this is really peripheral at the moment, as long as the federal government has a scheduling on this drug. And it's different. What you have to understand is that recently, so cannabinoids are inherently a GABA type of drug, and you have a naturally occurring cannabinoid in your brain, and it regulates anxiety. With the advent of the ability to, you know, genetically alter and genetically modify these type of cannabinoids, what's occurring is you have the strongest marijuana that you've seen in years and years and years. You know, I don't want to label it a gateway drug or not. I mean, every junkie I know drank milk first, so there's that. But what I do know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, is you're starting to see secondary problems with cannabis users, specifically in anxiety disorders, because their brain stops producing the cannabinoid that exists to regulate anxiety because it's being replaced. The bioavailability of marijuana is super high. It stores in adipose tissue, which is fat cells, which your brain is. There's a very long titration half-life, 18 months at times before you enter post-acute withdrawal. And it's becoming far more devastating. you know, I'm the doctor's age. I remember smoking weed young. Everybody smoked weed. I grew up in California, and not all of those people became junkies or addicts. I mean, thousands of them didn't. The majority of the ones I know didn't. So if there's, you know, first of all, there has to be a replacement of the federal statute on this. It has to be actually approved for research in a very quantifiable, technical way at the highest level of medical approaches. It has to be researched. The fact that it's illegal and scheduled as Schedule One, which has no medical basis, is what has prevented this type of reality. There's possibilities for all types of things. And, you know, the problem is that we see a lot of these new kind of things as medically assisted treatment, which theoretically is a sound program. However, what we see as MAT here is actually drug replacement therapy that's been around forever, started with opiates with methadone in the 60s and 70s, and it transfers. If we look at the methodology of harm reduction across the board, classic harm reduction has a final goal of abstinence. It's the way to treat that in a reduced kind of hazard area to bring about abstinence long term. So we have to be more open. We have to be honest. There has to be transparency about the drug. It has to be researched and funded correctly. And you have to stop incarcerating people for being sick, because that mentality is what destroys any real chance to make really strong forward strides against this disease.
Absolutely. Doctor, what is your opinion on cannabis for opiate treatment?
I concur really wholeheartedly with Mark shared. There's not much more to add on the scientific side. And I'm more of a proponent for anything that works, because what's happening isn't. So my open-mindedness has certainly become more evident as the advent of licensing in Florida has started to become more proliferate. Just last week, I was with another new licensee that opened up on West Atlantic Avenue right here in Delray, and their target market is the geriatric population in High Point. So when you start your career professionally, at least when we did here, you get exposed to a number of different populations. And we watched, at least for me, I watched the geriatric population hit Baker Act at every Friday night to fill beds in psychiatric hospitals, and the abuses of the Baker Act and other legislation and be given medication. There's no real longitudinal studies on a lot of these meds that have been prescribed. Marijuana's been around a long, long, long time. I've used it for pain relief back when I had a very careless accident back in 1974, and actually used it specifically in my own personal life to get off of opiates. And that was where my own receptor was open to morphine. If I were to show you the outcome of this, I had an amputation of my left hand, operating power equipment under the influence of various chemicals, blah, blah, blah. And I asked the doctors, again, this is anecdotal and nothing researched, but let me use pot instead of morphine. And they were like thrilled. It was like, what a great idea. And so, and then it stayed as a very effective. But again, just like, you know, our natural chemicals for pain relief that are getting replaced by opioids, the same thing with the cannabinoids and anxiety. What people really, really get really frightened about is running out. It's the same habit. They get cut. Their anxiety builds around, I'm going to run out, I'm going to run out, I'm going to run out. What do I do? What do I do? People won't travel. Like the methadone, you know, intervention, or now the Suboxone intervention, and now the marijuana intervention, it's going to be, what do I do when I can't get it anymore? Or what happened with the pill mills? If you were here for the pill mill epidemic that occurred in South Florida, and people made tons and tons of money, because it was really driven by one thing, again, driven by money, not by the well-being of the people. It's the same thing with the marijuana. We have to be very, very cautious about what the motives are behind people opening and the operators, et cetera. The intervention in and of itself is going to play out as it's going to. I think a lot of people are going to try it. I think I'm going to support them, because if it's going to keep them out of the hospital and keep them out of jail, yeah, I'm good with that. It's not my life, and that's the way it's going to roll. And I'm fine with that, because that's what part of being in recovery is about, is being open-minded and flexible and not so rigid.
Right, right. And a good point is what the Robert brought up, is that we've got a problem with the federal government. Like here in Florida, the medical marijuana is legal. You know, 71% of the state agreed upon that. But yet federally, It's not. And the same thing with even states like Colorado and California, where it's completely recreational, is even legal. The Jeff Sessions, you know, the attorney general, is still, you know, against marijuana. So that's a problem. I think, you know, they, you know, when you have the will of the people wanting one thing for medical use, and it's been proven, like the doctor said, for medical use, that it can be helpful. And then you have the federal government, you know, putting their will because maybe pharmaceutical wants to make more money. And that's a problem. Right. You know, like when you think about it, is it more toxic to take CBD oil or take Tylenol and Advil, which will kill your liver, you know, on a consistent basis? You're probably better off with the CBD, you know, with a little bit of low, high CBD, low THC, than to be taking, you know, even over-the-counter stuff, because it's, but we've got multi-billions of dollars being made by Big Pharma. And ironically, what's funny is, and sir, they're trying to make a synthetic, they did that with Marinol, but now they're trying to make it more synthetic marijuana, in, so they can sell it to us for hundreds of dollars a pill, through insurance companies. So everybody needs to be aware that there's, like you said, doctor, big money, you know, the motives, the motivation is not pure.
Well, when you look at the big money piece, you know, part of the problem with the federal stuff that, that Mark brought up and you also, you know, agreed with, is that all these dispensaries can't, they're basically committing crime. They can't put their money in the bank. So then the whole demarcation of cryptocurrency started to occur, which segues into what I'm doing. Is we created the sober coin to start to incentivize people for behavioral change. That's the outcome of what all of my work has been. We have, you know, training, we have a mobile app, and now we have this reward mechanism that we're getting ready to put in place to really upend the industry, because it's been stagnant for so long. Nothing has changed. It's the same, unfortunately, without any disrespect to Mark, the 12-step facilitation model, and people are, the population that we're trying to reach are not going to sit still for an hour. First of all, they don't even sit still for 20 minutes. So I don't know what anybody thinks they're going to sit in an AA meeting for an hour, because they don't. And anybody that's been to a meeting, watch them go in and out, because they are not programmed anymore to sit still that long. We have a 20-second attention span. That's what they're getting conditioned to, not a 60-minute attention span. So we need to really learn how to meet people where they're at, not where we think they are or where we think they should be, but where they truly, really are at.
That's an interesting point, because with the cell phones, it's true. You know, you actually, I think from, I've heard that we have less attention span than a goldfish in this day and age right now, because we're, you know, we're on the phone. To sit an hour without looking at your phone is probably a huge, huge. I mean, for kids,
No, they can't do it. If you take their phone, no, you got to withdraw. You have to talk about anxiety. You got a withdrawal symptom if you take their phone away. Now,
that's interesting. This is a form of addiction as well. And you know that we can talk about that as well. But there's something interesting. I'll just segmenting out into this. I have another thing on my notes here. There is the, I don't know if it's the first, but you mentioned the new currency, the cryptocurrency. And there's actually an addiction clinic in Scotland that opened, because there are people in financial analysts who are, you know, becoming addicted to the cryptocurrencies. And so it's like a gambling type of obsessive compulsive. So it's another thing like gambling, computer, cell phone addiction. So we're moving beyond just the physical substances. What is it? Do you guys treat people with these types of different addictions that you're, are you seeing more of this coming? I mean, we have eating disorder addictions as well, Mark?
Well, yeah, what we found and what we know absolutely vis-a-vis the science and, you know, the advent of PET scans and active CAT scans is that the stress reward system that is activated in the mesolimbic system between the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex is identical whether it's a substance abuse disorder or whether it's a process abuse disorder. And it used to be gambling was the number one step down after substances were passed over. But what we find now is porn is the number one. And in fact, the NIH is doing huge studies on it. And oddly enough, their data comes from Pornhub, one of the largest purveyors worldwide. All the metadata is going into these studies from that particular purveyor. And you do have to approach it the same way, because whether the neurochemicals are stimulated from an external replacement therapy through drugs or whether they start to develop this pathology, this speed pathology that occurs naturally with the neurochemicals in the brain, it's the same thing. Stress and reward. And what's lacking is and it's really bizarre, and I don't want to sound generalistic, but it's that spiritual component. And we have always pursued pleasure, regardless of the form that it comes in. because for whatever reason, growing up, the dynamics of the environment, the house, the society, the everything, it's a giant, giant storm of factors. But what we've always done is eschewed the pursuit of pleasure because it took too much effort, and we engaged in the pursuit, and we eschewed the pursuit of joy because it took too much effort, and engaged in the pursuit of pleasure, which was quick and easy. And somewhere around the line, that switch got flipped, and we have to look at how to flip it back, right? Because joy almost never contains that seed or the kernel of pain, whereas joy itself always does. Pleasure is about pleasure. I'm not going to sacrifice pleasure to get pleasure, but I'm willing to sacrifice pleasure to attain joy. It's the transcendence of that existential pain, of that little kernel to come internal. It's lasting. It's not transient. And that's really, I think, what's left, been lost. And I think that modern society has lost its ritual basis for these type of things, demarkers of growing up in adulthood. And, you know, the doctor talks about this like short attention span theater reality. This is instant gratification, and it's paramount. I mean, I'm a straight-up dosing and recovered alcoholic, and I can tell you that instant gratification was never fast enough for me. If I could speed that up to the speed of light, I'd do it every single time. And it took me to step back, because I'd always floundered under the misinformation that if I increased the intensity of the experience, the impact on me would be increased as well. But my experience, both personally and professionally, has shown that it's actually the opposite. I need to decrease intensity to increase impact, which is synonymous with saying I need to increase the potential for subtlety and sophistication. And in those things, in that minutia, I get the impact. And that's the spiritual paradigm that we have to teach. I don't know. I mean, we do it through inculcation or exposure. And, you know, talking back to what the doctor said earlier and what you also mimicked was you can't make somebody do something they don't want to. But what you can is create a circumstance where it makes it very attractive to them. And that's the bottom line, making it attractive, right? I always thought that I was cool to be a hard degenerate kid, and it turned out that being a dork is the coolest thing I've ever achieved in my entire life.
That's a really good point. And that brings up to what the doctor was saying about, you know, with the attention span and like being 20 seconds opposed to an hour. And I know there's a lot of apps and stuff too now with the 12 step trying to help people, you know, get on their phones and be able to, you know, to get the help. And doctor, you were talking about your coin as well. So is this going to be the wave of the future now? I'll start with Dr. Jonas, as far as, you know, having to meet people, like you put it, where they are at. And for treatment, is you think the industry is adapting to this technology-wise, trying to get get people right on their phone somehow to treat them?
Well, it's interesting. I created apps back in 2012. We called it Sober Systems. It's an app for accountability, because that's the component aside, and in addition to the spiritual piece that's void in many, many people. And as Mark had indicated, accountability is the next piece that's really been absent as well. Is that left to their own devices, people have a tendency to really saturate their pleasure sensors as opposed to what Mark calls joy and psychic fulfillment. So the apps are slow to be adopted. There's billions of dollars that have been poured into the app market. There's an app for everything. My app was recognized by SAMHSA for medication-assisted treatment. It's award-winning, and yet nobody will use it in the treatment industry, mainly because, you know, the industry is designed for people to fail and come back in the front door. So they say, see you later. Go to a meeting, join a home group, get a sponsor, and hopefully you'll live to come back soon, because we know you're going to come back, without saying that, you know, right directly to them. The statistics, which are very, very far and few between, of success, and that, again, is one of those broad-based terms of what is success, what is recovery, are very, very, very abysmal at best. We know that the 12-step model doesn't calculate any data. It's only estimates and self-reports. So we really are at a loss as an industry, so to speak, professionally, to really determine what is really effective for the majority of people. That's why there's so many starts in so many different directions. And again, I have a pet peeve that a lot of the interventions are designed for people of a certain ethnic and racial background, as opposed to the general consensus who can't access services. thus the reason for my development of mobile applications, because everybody has a phone, everybody can do this. It's not limited to the white suburban kids that are struggling with like being disenfranchised and they lost their driver's license. This is like for the kids on the corner who can sell drugs or go to McDonald's to work. And you know, those are the options, and that's the population that we need to reach, because, hey, in reality, they all vote, and they all are eligible to vote, and we need to be able to swing things in a larger way than we currently are relying on. So we have this whole ecosystem here at Sober Network. One of them is the training for coaches. The other one is a mobile app for accountability, and finally, this incentivized model with the coin to help everybody access services with this method to get better and stay better. And it'll be up to them once they learn how to like access this and we do the marketing push to make that happen.
You really bring up a really important point about the fact of, and it's true, I mean, it's, you know, you're both in the addiction field, but we do see this. It's very expensive to get treatment. And if you don't have insurance, we've had many people write in. I've had people message me at Addiction 911. I don't have insurance. I need help. Right. Where do I go? And, you know, and that's not what the, unfortunately, the addiction community as a whole, generalizing, they want the money. I mean,
there's one public facility that people can access under Marchman Act if they're indigent. It's called the Drug Abuse Foundation in Delray Beach, Florida. And that's for all of Palm Beach County. Okay.
And this is outrageous.
It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. So they want to, you know, make more beds. There aren't enough beds. There's not enough qualified people to provide services. And we can go on and on for another half a day, surely, with this conversation. You know, so we know what the problem is there. What are the solutions? The solutions are, oh, more beds, more money. But no, that's not the solution, because there's no efficacy to determine that what they're doing is effective. And what are they defining as recovery? So the best way is to meet people where they're at and have them report on their terms and then give them an incentive to do something different, like get better, stay better with money. The only thing people respond to is money. They don't respond to like, oh, you know what? I lost my finger. Do you think that got me to stop using drugs? No, it got me to switch drugs. I lost my license. You got me to stop driving drunk? No, I decided to take Uber and keep drinking. People lose their arms, their limbs, their loved ones, and they still are at it. Okay, I'm getting a little bit passionate and a little bit angry because I hear a lot of people talk about a lot of problems. I don't hear a lot of people talk about solutions. And I'm a very solution-oriented person, and that's essentially where I'm at with this conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. And I'll Rabbi, respond to that. What are your thoughts on what he just said?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, let me say that I agree with the doctor on the simple fact that not everyone is a nail, so hammers are not applicable at all times. I also agree absolutely that population targeting and demographic targeting for different disparity in patients is absolutely necessary. You have to look at the multifaceted realities and address them where they are. As far as the tracking goes, we now have a lot of things that are developing in the last 3 to 5 years under SAMHSA approval. We have, for instance, there's a BISTA tracking unit, which continues to track in terms of success, and it's a real-time tracking, pre-entry, during, post-facto. Also, there is, believe it or not, there is a tracking capacity of 12-step models. They have a census that they put out, but that's not how they do it. It's a little subversive. So in terms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the General Service Conference actually has pretty accurate numbers. They decided not to redo a copyright on the Circle Triangle, which is the logo in before the production of the fourth edition. What they did is they made a deal with people that produce coins, and each coin is minted with a year, and it's pretty much a standard small T tradition across the planet to give these on when people have anniversaries. And so they get the data from these companies, and they have a fairly good algorithmic way to approach this. The numbers that they put out, the problem is those numbers and their information doesn't go to the general public, because the society itself tends to fall under the purview of anonymity. But we are starting to see more and more trackable realities that are coming up through things. Specifically, this is one of the cutting-edge tracking things that we have. But that notwithstanding, we do see efficacy across the board in multiple different approaches. The ability to track it, to make it scientific, to be quantifiable is what we're working on now across the board, regardless of the treatment protocol or the way we approach it. And there is something to be said about the fact that there are very few beds for people that can't afford them. Here at Recovery Bootcamp, what we offer is there's actually a foundation that scholarships quite a few people. I think maybe 20% of our beds here are scholarship beds, because we understand that paradigm. And we're pretty much everyone that works here is recovered themselves. And we understand that, the far-reaching spectrum of people and their history and where they come from, the dynamics and the social strata, all those things come into play. And we do our best to offer that to the people that are. And, the Schnellenberger Family Foundation, Coach Schnellenberger from University of Miami and the Dolphins, who struggled with all three of his sons in addiction, and they facilitate. And it's, I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's everything that we can do incrementally is going to lead to a bigger ability to do that in the long run, and it's we have to bring in every single factor from every single community and every single approach and everything. And for instance, we have, to get back to this idea of the short attention span, how do you make the technology accessible? It's starting to get that way. We actually here, we're one of the few facilities that offers a virtual reality program that's a curriculum-based program. It's actually from Dr. Phil, who initially did it. And you put on the VR glasses, and you're sitting on the stage in a Dr. Phil show with the audience, and it's very immersive. And again, is it going to be the win, the end-all, be-all? No, but it's another thing that brings, how do we transmit the information in a way that's accessible and meets the client where they are, understanding the necessity for things to be in shorter increments, in more impactful realities? How do we utilize the technology to actually do our job better? That's right. The bottom line.
Yeah, that's good. That's really great advice. I mean, you did bring up a good point. I just want to backtrack to what you said about scholarships. Now, as if you're watching and you're having a hard time getting your loved one into treatment or yourself, many treatment centers do offer scholarships. That is one bright spot that you could try to call around and see if there's anybody having any open scholarships. That is a way to try to get in, get that treatment. That was a very good point. So we're at
You have to ask.
Let's be serious here, folks. Let's interrupt here. That asking, you're talking to an admissions counselor on the phone that has 6 months to a year clean, who's answering a phone room call, number one. And if you don't get to the CEO or you don't know somebody to ask, chances of you getting that scholarship bed are slim. So you have to push to the CEO and or the person that has the authority to make that decision to authorize a scholarship service, whether that be a recovery boot camp or anywhere else. You just can't call that admissions office and expect to get a scholarship, because it just doesn't work that way. Otherwise, the doors would be pounded on every day,
which that's what reality is.
So let's qualify this scholarship stuff and be clear on what we're offering to people live, in that it just doesn't work as simply as like, oh, do you have any scholarships? And you're going to say, oh, yeah, come on over. It just isn't that reality. So okay. I'm sorry to interrupt.
There are limited beds. That's real. And you have to be aware of those 800 numbers in the clearinghouses. That's true.
Right.
If you ever you build a relationship with a center, you call them, you talk to them, you find out the information, and then you pose the question. It takes a bit of work. It always takes a bit of work. Everything does. Getting sober takes a bit of work. And
We're talking about a distraught parent that's calling around to save their kid's life. They're not building relationships with treatment centers to get a scholarship bed. They're desperate.
Well, desperation is also a relationship.
I said enough. Thank you.
No, that's all right. I just wanted to interrupt to there are groups and organizations who can help you with this if you're a parent. Like, number one, the Addict's Mom, which is my friend Barbara Beto. Barbara has personally gotten many, many people scholarships. So mothers, if you join our Facebook, the Addict's Mom, She's somebody who can, you know, they can definitely help you. And there's other organizations just like that, that can intervene on your behalf, that have connections. And what I want to leave with, well, as we, because we're at our hour now, is I want both of you to give everyone your contact information, how they can get in touch with you, because you both offer tremendously wonderful services. You're both honest, high integrity addiction professionals. So people out there who need help, how, let's start with the doctor. How do they contact you? What's the best way to get in touch with you?
The best way is through my email, Jonas, J-O-N-A-S, at SoberNetwork.com. I'm very responsive to email. My phone number, if you'd like to call directly, is 561-441-5004. And if I'm unavailable, I usually return calls in the evening. Those are your best methods to get a hold of me if you want information. I have a number of websites, Sober.com, SoberSystems.com, RecoveryCoaches.com, and soon SoberCoin.net is live, so you'll be able to see that and sign up for a the pre-sale of what we're going to be distributing here in the very near future.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Jonas. I mean, I really thank you for being a guest today. You've been absolutely wonderful. Rabbi, tell us how the listener now can, the viewer can get in touch with you, because this is also going to be on our podcast, which will be on iTunes and Podomatic too. So you may be listening or watching. Tell us, how do we get in touch with you?
You can call me directly to my office number, which is 561-563-8887. You can talk to Nick Johnson, who is our intake coordinator, but is also empowered to do the things that we talked about and is more than 6 months sober and is an alumni and an active member in his own recovery. And it's 561-563-8888 or 8880. Or you can email me at any time at rabbimark@recoverybootcamp.com.
Well, thank you so much.
Call me direct.
You've been absolutely wonderful, too. And I just want to leave you, anybody watching or listening, this is, you know, we brought up the point, which Dr. Howell brought up, Jonas brought up a great point of that, you know, just calling around, you know, not knowing anybody. That's why we do this show. So we can bring professionals like we have here today, experts, to you, so you can get to know them, see that these are really compassionate, caring people who really want to help. And we have that with Dr. Jonas and Robert Rottenberg today. Wonderful interview today with both of you. And I think that's what really makes it real, that anybody watching or listening can contact you both and, you know, and have a connection now, a foot in the door somewhere to get some help. So thank you, both of you. You were absolutely amazing today. And anybody listening, please feel free to reach out to both the doctor and the rabbi, and know that there is help and there's people, good people out there in this field who care about you and want to help you. So thank you, everybody, today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Christine.
Thank you, Christine. Nice meeting you, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Nice meeting you, Doc.